Hey everyone, welcome back to Seeking What They Saw, and we are here with Larry Blackmer, and he's our special guest today to go into this series on Avenus Education. And this is one we've wanted to do for a while. I know, especially me, maybe not Jesse. I think Jesse's been reluctant to do Avenus Education. Anthony, you're just ambivalent about it, but I was the most excited because if you don't know, most of you probably know, but I am an Avenus teacher. I'm going into my 10th year, which makes me feel like a dinosaur for some reason, because I feel like I just left college. I don't know why that I feel like that, but
John, Larry,
Larry
just chuckled at you. Those are rookie numbers.
Yeah, I know those are rookie numbers. Yeah. Yeah, he's not impressed by that.
I'm a fossil. You're a dinosaur. I'm a fossil.
Yeah, but it is crazy just talking to other teachers that I graduated with, like how that time has gone by. Many of them are no longer teachers. Some of them are. But it's a tough business, education, and a lot of commitment with that. But Larry, again, we're so excited to have you here with us. You retired in 2018. You were the vice president at the NAD level, and you were, of course, specialized in education for that. Now, yes. Even prior to that, I know that you also worked at the NAD level before that as an associate and different levels of administration before that throughout your career. Now, what was like your first assignment in education? So did you graduate college and you went straight into education, or how, like, just give us a little crash course on your journey to Avenus Education.
I was a biology, chemistry, physics major in college, and I was going to
all
be
all three.
Yeah.
Wow.
I know.
That's incredible.
And then I was going to be a research biologist, but there were 2000 applicants for every job in the 70s.
Wow.
And so I'd worked at summer camp for 5 years and loved kids and decided to try education. My first job was in Lansing, Michigan, teaching grades 7 and 8, all subjects. And that was quite a faith journey for that board, because I ain't always the best in some English and some other things. But yeah, I taught 7th and 8th grade. And then the next year I moved to Grand Ledge Academy as a teacher, biology, chemistry, physics, and wood shop. And then the following, about 4 years later, I became the principal. Not there 9 years, I was principal at Adelphian Academy, principal and boys dean. And the year closed. It was a difficult year. And then went to Mount Pisgah Academy in Asheville, North Carolina. Another boarding school, spent 5 years there, went to Tacoma Academy as principal, just outside of Washington, D.C. That was probably my favorite assignment in all the assignments I've had as far as administration. And then Michigan as associate superintendent, Idaho as superintendent, the division as an associate, and the division as the vice president. So,
wow.
You worked your way right up.
Yeah, some people just can't keep a job.
I was going to say, what a resume.
I'm curious, you spent a lot of time in education from the beginning to maybe when you really moved into admin. Let's say when you left the local school. From the beginning to the point where you left the local school, what did you feel like changed, and what do you feel like stayed the same in Adminis education over those years?
For me as a person?
I guess maybe more so, because there's been a lot of change recently in Adminis education. It's felt over the last maybe 2 decades. So I don't know if you felt some of that change, or if it felt like it primarily stayed the same, your experience teaching in Adminis education, or I'm curious about that.
When I first got into Adminis education, it was in the late 70s. Early 80s, teachers were not allowed to have facial hair.
Ooh. Sorry, Sean.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And
that was a pastor thing too, right? At some point.
Yeah, it was a pastor thing.
Sean, you would have gone from looking like you were 45 to looking like you were 12.
I know.
So fast.
That's why I had the beard, was at the start of teaching my first year. I just wanted to distinguish as much as possible. I'm an adult, okay? You have to respect me.
I started going gray at 27, the year I became an academy principal. So
wow.
I think they're
sure
probably
that helped.
Connected. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a correlation there.
Yeah.
No, I think there's been a lot of change, not only in Adventist education, but I think that change is centered in the church itself more than centered in Adventist education. Mm-hmm. I think we moved from that legalistic do's and don'ts to the more relationship by faith. And mm-hmm. I've seen that swing back and forth in the last 45, 50 years. And so I think Adventist education is in a good place compared to where it was years ago. I know when I went to my first interview, I was, 22? My wife was 22. And I remember at that meeting, one of the board members looking under the table to see what my wife was wearing.
Oh, wow. Yikes.
So I think we've come a long way from that kind of introspection as a church. And I think Adventist education has as well.
Is there some facts that Sean had brought up that Adventist education is in 150 countries, 85,000 teachers, 1.5 million students, 7,500 schools. I even remember all three of us went to Auburn Adventist Academy in Washington State. And I remember we had about, was it 350? 350 to 400 students.
310 graduated.
Over 300. Never mind, yeah.
310. So 310 students. But I remember that they talked about in the past, they had close to 500, if not more.
I think it was 600. Yeah. It was huge.
Well, that was nice. When another school closed down. And then so that all the students.
Oh, yeah.
But at a normal high, it was like in the 450s to 500s. And then it had slowly come down. And then out of some, there was a crash in 08. We all graduated in 2010. There's a crash in 08, some other stuff that happened specifically at our school, but it went down to, I think, under 200 for a bit and then has rebounded to a little bit over 200. But my point being is when I mentioned that there's been a lot of change in Adventist education over the last two decades, it feels like in my limited viewpoint, Adventist education has experienced a downward trend in enrollment and money over the last couple of decades. Is that true first? But then second, and this is in more North America, but is that true first? And if so, has that been a lot longer in happening, or has that really been a thing of the last couple of decades?
So the peak enrollment, and I don't have my graphs in front of me here, but so I'll be doing it by memory. But I've talked about it a little. Our peak enrollment was in 1976. That was our peak enrollment in Adventist education. And we have slipped a steady decline until about 2016, in that ballpark. And we've started to inch up a bit since then. I think COVID really, we've had quite an uptick in enrollment since COVID, not only the Adventist Church, but I work with the Catholics and the Baptists and the Lutherans and the Jewish schools across many countries, and most of them have had an uptick in enrollment as well. I think the decline from 1976 to where we were in 2016 or so, a lot of that has to do with parental choice, parental decisions that they've made. I think we lost a lot of, so back in, let me see how to approach this. When I go around and speak at alumni weekends around the country, and I do that a fair amount or did, I would always have people come up and say, I haven't darkened the door in an Adventist church for the last 30 years. Mm. And I was kicked out of the academy for eating a hot dog. That's a true story.
Yeah.
And I've never darkened the door since.
I believe it.
Those individuals became parents. And those individuals had stories to tell to their peers. And I think a lot of the backlash against Adventist education came from those very legalistic years in which kids had to dig a 4x4 because they had a radio, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
You all know the stories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's our job as a church to help heal those stories. I gave out a lot of diplomas for individuals that got kicked out of school their senior year.
Wow.
And I would find out about that and try to get a hold of the school if I was speaking there for the weekend and get an honorary diploma for that.
Wow.
For that student.
Wow.
And I don't know how many times I've had people that have said that's changed their life. That's just one little thing. If we, each one of us, took those kinds of responsibilities onto ourselves to mend fences and to mend broken spirits, we'd be a lot better off.
That's rich. Wow.
Have you gotten any pushback for doing any of that? Like there's this push and pull factor of upholding a certain standard of, we are an Adventist school. There's a certain expectation of if you've signed on to be here, if you've chosen to be here, this is how we are. This is what we do. And so if you don't abide by that, then it's not going to work out. So how do you balance that concept of being set apart for something specific, having a certain identity, but also you have those stories of baggage? What made you decide, and how did you analyze which cases to say, yeah, this was too far, they deserve an honorary diploma, versus, oh, there's a good reason they didn't graduate?
To be honest, if a student wanted that diploma and they, and it wasn't something that they were kicked out for drugs or something like that, if it was just a culmination of things or a hot dog or leaving campus without permission or something like that, then forgiveness is what we all have to give. And hope for the future is what we have to provide for everyone. Mm-hmm. So I would do my best, if administration would allow it. What's an honorary diploma? They can't use it to get into college. And they're 50 years old anyhow.
Sure.
And been holding this for 30 years.
Yeah.
Why not try to heal that and move on? Because it's not hurting anybody to say, I'm sorry you felt that way. I don't have to say, I'm sorry the school did that to you.
Yeah.
What we have to do is say, I'm sorry you felt that way and you still feel that way. And deal with it on a personal level, and don't try to excuse what the school did, because they did it and that's what they did.
Yeah.
But we can apologize for how people feel and what we have done to make them feel that way.
Yeah.
Wow. I feel like what you just said, Larry, the difference between those two things is very nuanced. And I think sometimes we conflate the two, but you're saying there's actually a difference between saying, hey, we're condoning what you did or whatever. But even if we're not condoning it, we're still apologizing. We're trying to reconcile for how you might have been made to feel.
Yep.
Wow.
It's interesting because I use that phrase, but I guess what I really mean is it feels like it's a challenging tightrope to walk for Christian education, because it is. So let's say with a public school, like, you break the handbook rules, you broke a clear line, we kick you out. It's a school, you know. When it's Christian education, there's also the weight of religion and potentially how an authority figure can take an unconscious or very explicit feeling of, this is what God is doing to me through this authority figure. And so
projecting it on God, you're saying.
Whatever wrong. Like, it feels like it, especially we had some funny experiences. Like, one time we had a vice principal get up and say, we shouldn't talk loudly in the cafeteria. I think his whole idea was that he wanted it quieter in the cafeteria. But his whole thing was that it's because it messes with your digestion if you talk loudly in the
We're like, because, well, none of the science checks out.
But then, so then what's funny is, because of Ellen White and because of a lot of the food and diet things within Adventism, when he says that, whether or not he means it to be like a religious sounding thing, it very easily gets intermingled with that.
Yeah.
And so there's so many things that I would imagine get intermingled with a religious, or God is doing this to somebody, or this is what religion does, this is what people who follow Jesus do. So it feels like the standard for care has to be immensely higher at a Christian educational institute, because you have that ability to damage people so greatly and damage their religious experience so greatly.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah. When I was a principal, I think particularly at Tacoma Academy, I would always start the year by saying, I'm the administrator. I make the rules. The rules are not made by God. The rules are not made by the Bible. The rules are not made by the pastor. They're made by me, the administrator. For instance, dress code. I can decide, we as a faculty can decide whether you wear a burqa or a bikini and whether those are acceptable. But our rule of thumb is to make our rules so that they are back away from the edge, so that when you cross the line, you're not going to get damaged. And we're that way as adults, right? If it's a 55 mile an hour speed zone, we're all driving 60. We know that if you drive 66, 11 miles over, you're going to get a ticket. Yeah. So we drive 5 or 6 or 7 miles over, just over the line, but not to the place where we're going to get a ticket. And kids are the same way. You might as well admit it and talk about it.
Yeah.
And we instituted uniforms at Tacoma Academy in an urban school in the early 90s. That was an unheard of thing to have uniforms in an urban school. But by the time we implemented those uniforms, the students had voted it, the parents had voted, the board had voted it, and there were reasons for it. It wasn't just another school down the road saw that we were doing uniforms in July, announced to the parents that they were going to institute uniforms in August or September.
Oh, wow.
It was an absolute disaster.
Yeah.
But we had a number of incidents on the Tacoma Academy campus in which people would come on campus that were not supposed to be there and beat people up or cause problems. And so I explained to the students, if I can look down the hallway and everybody's in a green shirt and somebody walks in with a red shirt, I know they're out of place. I know they don't belong. Isn't that a safety issue?
Yeah.
Yes. And by the end, and then I said, you guys choose the uniform. We're not going to choose it. You choose it. And they chose shorts and skirts and khakis. That was the uniform. As long as everybody agreed to it, the whole purpose was to have a safer environment. And in the end, we did. If we were just to say, this is my rule, you do it. Leviticus 7:12 says.
Yeah, and that's a helpful, obviously, in the classroom too, Larry. That's a classic piece of advice I got pretty early on was, if you make class rules with your classroom, have them help make it with you. Like we all have to agree, these are the rules for our classroom versus these are my rules. And that changes, they take ownership of that. So then instead, when someone breaks the rule, it's like, this is what we made together versus this is our teacher's unrealistic, out of touch, irrelevant rules.
Especially that this is something, because I think some of the damage that has been done over the years, and it sounds like you're more aware of this than I could ever be, Larry, but it seems to me that some of the damage has been done is because it wasn't even an arbitrary rule. It was a rule that felt like it was connected to scripture in some sort of way, or at least had some sort of religious cultural backing that meant that they for eating a hot dog, now they're kicked out. It's like, that's some pretty wild stuff that definitely is going to cause a lot of damage. And I guess that's why I say, and it is refreshing to hear you've talked about it, but that's why it seems like the standard of care has to be so much higher, because if not, any sort of lack of intentionality in that space, I feel like then can very easily become, oh yeah, this is the religion doing this to me, rather than these are the rules of a school. This is what we had to come to. And it does sound like a lot of the time religious language got used in ways.
Yes.
Almost and intentionally to try and uphold a standard. And that has seemed to have done a lot of damage.
You take a boarding school right now, they are in the toughest position because they say no jewelry, no meat, no music, no phones, on the church standards, the old, and those church standards are imposed by gray-haired boards that live. They want the school to be the moral standard for the church.
City on the hill, yeah.
But yet, the kid goes home on the weekend and goes to church, and the lady elder on the stage has great big old long earrings and a plunge neckline, and as soon as church is over with, they all go out to Denny's for dinner, and it's such a double standard.
Yeah.
And administrators at the boarding school level are in a really bad spot because they've got a constituency over here that's trying to uphold the rules of the church and the standards, if you will, of the church. But yet the church itself is not upholding those standards. And so you've got this, the kids are so.
They see that.
Traumatized by that because they don't know what to do. And then they get kicked out for having a hot dog, but yet they're serving coffee in the lobby of the church.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jesse.
What do you think has changed? So it seems like, because you had said that some of the issue was that people got really badly hurt and then didn't want to put their own kids into that. It also seems like the reason for Adventist education has slipped, maybe because of some of the damage, but also, especially recently, it feels like we can't financially keep up with some of the standards of education. And this is an outside looking in. So Sean, you could probably say more about this, as can you, Larry, but it just seems like we struggle with funding and finances to be able to keep up a lot of the extra stuff that kind of made Adventist education pretty unique. And we used to have shop. We had an airport nearby where we'd do piloting classes and stuff. That was all stuff that happened in the past. A dairy. Jobs on campus, all this stuff. But it feels like in a lot of places that hasn't necessarily been able to be kept up because of funding. And so I guess I'm wondering, is there a kind of a cart before the horse thing there? Was it the slip that then led to funding declines? And I don't know exactly how to describe that, but it just seems like that has been a piece of the puzzle. We're not able to keep up with standards of education in the same way.
I think a number of things. I think that there are decisions made early on in the church and they're still being held as standards in the church. Pastors and teachers have to be exactly the same. You can't pay a teacher more than a pastor. They may have a PhD and 30 years experience and et cetera, et cetera. And the pastor has a high school diploma, but they have to be paid the same because the pastor is the highest level of the church. And so there's this glass ceiling that teachers are bumping up against. And then cost of living goes up. They look around in public schools paying twice what. And I will tell you that the Adventist Church is in the top 25% of private schools, other than independent schools, for teacher pay. If you take denominational schools, we're in the top 10% in pay in denominational schools. The Lutherans and the Baptists and the Catholics pay a lot less than we do. We look around and we see public school teachers and we compare ourselves to that, but we don't look and see what we're compared to other denominational employees. I think so why do we have Adventist education? Why do we do that? Why do we spend, in some cases, 70 or 80% of our combined budget on the school? Why? Is it so that we can have the highest academics in the community? Is that why we spend that kind of money? No, I don't think so. Is it so that we can have a safe environment for our kids? Is that why we spend 80% of our combined budget? No, I don't think it is. is it so we can have the best basketball team in the county? No. Is it so our kids know Jesus as their personal savior? Is that why we spend 80%? No, I don't think that it is. Because they can go to a Baptist school and know Jesus. And they can go to a Catholic school and know Jesus. Why we spend 80% of our combined budget on a school is so that our kids have a solid academic foundation. And we can prove through Value Genesis that we do fantastic in academics. We don't have all of the bells and whistles, but a kid, when they come out of an academy, has the ability to go to any school in the world. Is it so that they have a safe environment? Yes, they have to be safe. They have to be safe physically, emotionally, and spiritually. And I think Adventist education does that. Is it so they know Jesus? Yes, it is. But the whole point is that they have to have a strong academics in a safe environment where they know Jesus in the context of the Adventist church. And if you leave that last one off, then you're just growing Jesus-loving Baptists and Jesus-loving Methodists. You're not growing Adventists. And I think that sometimes we've gotten away from that, and we try to be that Christian school, that general Christian school down the road. And I think we lose our distinctiveness in doing that. They want to be distinctive. Parents want their kids to be Adventists as they grow up. Not as much, I think, as my parents did, or probably your parents. I think that desire, that end goal has gotten, instead of a path to heaven, a path to righteousness, a path to a Christian life, has morphed more to a path towards a Ivy League school, or a path to a higher degree, or et cetera, et cetera. More money.
Yeah.
And I think that we've lost some of those distinctivenesses in the church.
Are you saying, Larry, that in your perspective, the goal of Adventist education primarily is to make Adventists, first and foremost, beyond other things?
The goal of Adventist education is that every student knows Jesus Christ as their personal savior within the context of the Adventist church.
Mm.
That's my position.
What would you say is, or multiple, plural, are the distinguishing factors? And this even gets back to our series on what is an Adventist, right? Because this is the challenges we had a series of people on to describe or define to us as leaders of the church what an Adventist is. And what we learned from that, and we learned a lot of valuable things in listening to other people, whether we agreed with them or not, is that there's a varying opinion of what is the core of Adventism.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the challenge. Is it seems to be that some of the maybe challenge you speak about when it comes to not having the distinguishing factor in the schools is maybe a symptom of what's going on in the church at large.
Yeah.
As our culture. So if that's a challenge, it's going to bleed into our system and our employees, professionals, administrators, if that's the tension that's being felt.
Yeah.
So what is, in your opinion, or from your perspective, what are those distinguishing cornerstones that make Adventist education distinguishable and maybe as a byproduct more successful?
So there are five doctrines that set us apart from other denominations. And from my perspective, the Sabbath, right? There's Seventh-day Baptist, but in general, the Sabbath is one of those distinctive theologies. The sanctuary, the state of the dead, spirit of prophecy, and nobody can ever name the fifth one. Can you name the fifth one that's a distinctive that the Adventist church holds that nobody else deals with?
Let's see. Sabbath, Sanctuary, State of the Dead.
I swear we went spirituality.
Yeah.
Second coming.
Here's your quiz.
Yeah.
There's lots of churches that believe in the second coming. They may believe a little differently here and there about how it's going to happen.
Okay.
The remnant church.
Oh, that's not nice. Okay. Interesting.
Nobody else deals with the remnant church. And if those are our five distinctives, our five pillars that are different from everybody else, when's the last time you heard a sermon about the sanctuary and the relevance of the sanctuary to the Adventist church? In church, unless you are in an evangelistic series, you're not going to hear that. You're not going to hear about the state of the dead or the five distinctives. Maybe the Sabbath, you hear that's an easy one for pastors to preach on. And I'm not on pastor's case here. I'm just because we've lost about two or three generations that hold those as dear personal values in their life. And so if you've lost two generations, are they teaching it in their family worships? No, because they don't understand them themselves. They don't understand the sanctuary and the relevance of the sanctuary to the Advent message. They couldn't articulate that to you if you asked them. And so it's not being taught in church. Pathfinders doesn't teach it. Sabbath school hits it not here or there. So we've got two or three generations, and we're about to go four and five generations in which we're not talking about the distinctives, why we're different. And if we lose those differences, if you take those five or you take four, you leave the Sabbath, you're going to have Sabbath-keeping Baptists and Sabbath-keeping Lutherans and Sabbath-keeping Methodists, because we're not going to be any different than they are if you lose those other four distinctives. And Adventist education, we hit those four distinctives, five distinctives, at least four times in a 12-year curriculum. And so we are trying to instill those distinctives so that we as a church can continue to be that distinctive church that God wants us to be. Go ahead.
So if Adventist education is primarily about making followers of Jesus, but in the Adventist context, I agree with that in principle, but it does seem like there's a good deal of stuff that kids are dealing with in this day and age that isn't, like, the Adventist distinctives aren't answering the questions that they're asking generally. And that's because part of it is that we have become less of a quote unquote Christian nation. I guess by that, we used to take for granted that most people had a Christian, basic Christian understanding that was a foundation to build off of. And if we could talk about some correction of theology, then people could come out to a more holistic picture of God. We don't have that same reality now. And I think you're right to identify in Adventist families, there's definitely less of a space where, what's the right word? There's less of a space where Adventism at its core is the main point. There's a lot more people who are teaching their kids about Jesus and like some Adventist stuff, but not let's get into the Bible and get into the sanctuary doctrine. There's definitely a lot less of that, I think. All of that does leave a lot of kids with less of a biblical foundation than maybe previously. But then it seems like our answer is to then just go back in and teach them Adventist distinctives instead of what is the core foundation of Scripture. That's what I'm hearing. And so I guess I'm curious about, like, what is the way now that we are trying to teach following Jesus? Because I can add one more thing to the conversation here. Yes, it's true that kids are asking different questions, but also we have been teaching people for a long time about ideas rather than practical, like relationship with Jesus, what that experience should feel like, looks like, all that stuff. And so I guess I'm curious, what is our approach now to try and solve what is being asked in 2024 instead of maybe what was being asked a few decades ago?
Yeah. One of the last things we instituted when I was in the office was a new Bible curriculum called Encounter Bible. And I think it's been extremely successful across the division. Sean, I don't know if you use Encounter Bible.
Yeah, I teach Bible, so I've used it since 2017.
Yep.
And yep. I teach junior high, so the high school one rolled out sooner, and then the junior high elementary,
right?
Yeah, around 2017, I think it started.
Yep. And the whole purpose of that is not to make them memorize the books of the Bible and 87 proof texts before they get out of academy. The whole purpose of that is to help kids to have an encounter with Jesus, a personal relationship with Jesus. I use an analogy. I'm a fisherman, and I've made a decision that I'm never going to fish in a swimming pool. Why would I not fish in a swimming pool?
Nothing to catch.
There's no fish.
There's nothing to catch. And I think spirituality is caught, not taught. Religiosity is taught. Spirituality is caught. And I think that we have to have teachers and preachers that have something to catch. They have to be infectious. If we had, in my almost humble opinion, if we had 100% of our teachers and preachers that were infectious for Jesus and had that personal relationship that every student wanted to catch, we'd be in a different place.
So what's created the culture for that not to be the case? So this is where I go back and forth a bit, Larry, because I hear you on the five distinctives, having a clear goal. And it seems to be there's a bit of tension there, because we just about 20 minutes ago talked about how some were burnt out on Adventist education, not on those specific five things, but the cultural distinctions, like don't eat the hot dog, don't wear jewelry. Those are byproducts of our cultural and eventually biblical understanding of scripture, things that are pretty unique to Adventism, what to do on Sabbath, what not to do, right? I'm sure kids were kicked out for doing certain things on Sabbath they weren't supposed to do. So you have this challenge of, well, it could be easy to interpret what you're saying as, well, you're asking me to do two things. You're asking me to both uphold the distinctives. And I'm not accusing you of this. I'm playing devil's advocate, of course. I'm saying the tension could be, you're asking me to both uphold the distinctives and be clear on the expectations of what an Adventist institution and its teachers and administrators are all about, and the students, while also having this grace-oriented, safe, infectious place for Jesus that's not just steeped in pure religion, but also the spirituality, the connection to Jesus. It seems like it could be interpreted as two separate things, where I'm both trying to let this be caught, but then if it's about the distinctives, it's hard for me to pick and choose one or the other. It's hard to combine both, I think, is the struggle for Adventism.
But I think that's the whole point. I think that, Sean, is the key, is if we present those five distinctives in a relationship with Christ, if we present those things as to have the best relationship to Christ, you need to understand what he's doing for you right now in heaven, in that sanctuary service. And it's a personal relationship. You need to build that, not as a doctrine that you can quote and write down on a piece of paper, but as a relationship that you have to build, and that these five things are important to that relationship. That's how we meld those two together. I think you're right. I think we, if, and what I say, how I say it might be interpreted sometimes as saying, you got to preach these five things and drill it into their heads. That's not it at all. My whole point is, if we lose those concepts, if we lose those distinctives as a church. And why do we have the distinctives? Because they're important to our spiritual life. They're important to our relationship to Christ. And so I think we have to present them in those, in that fashion.
Yeah, my suspicion, I'm not going to put Anthony and Jesse on the spot, but we've had conversations about this both in previous series, and then we're actually doing an upcoming series on sanctuary, investigative judgment, having people on to deep dive into that. My suspicion from the many discussions we've had and just my sense, this is anecdotal, is that Adventism at large, at least within North America, that's what I can mostly speak for,
yep,
is that there's probably two of those five distinctives that we would probably say pretty easily across the board, yes, let's find a healthy way to do that, which would be Sabbath and State of the Dead. I don't think there's a lot of pushback against those two. I think the last three, you're going to see a lot of strong divisiveness and probably, honestly, in my experience, apathy, like just in what's the word? Indifference, right?
Yeah.
So whether it's just, yeah, if you bring up the word remnant, it's like a swear word in Adventism at this point. Sanctuary, it's more just utter confusion. Like we just don't know what to do with that. And then Spirit of Prophecy, another mix of confusion, yeah, and a bit of
been beat up with it.
Yeah, it's been beat over the head. And a lot of baggage. Those people you've probably talked to, and I've talked to many too in my own church that grew up where they didn't spend a lot of time reading the Bible in class. They read more Ellen White than the Bible in Bible, yeah, class.
Yeah.
And when we went through, I actually, in a Bible study group, went through the Desire of Ages with the Bible. They said it was their first time reading cover to cover Ellen White. They had only heard quotes from her. And they suddenly got like, hey, I get the space Ellen White exists in Adventism now, having read her,
mm-hmm,
alongside the Bible. I get it. Not to just like totally buy in, but to be like, oh, I get that there's some beauty here versus being beat over the head with quotes in Bible class, where it's just this baggage experience. And these were 50 and 60 year olds being like, yeah, whoa, hey, there's actually something healthy here. So that's my concern, is if you believe that those are the five distinctives, that without that identity, and really it's bigger than just Adventist education, you'd probably say, Larry, that this has to be the mission of the church. Would you say
that's
that?
Right.
To have that, yeah, the education system of Adventism is a symptom or a product of whatever is happening in our churches.
Yep.
So if that's the case, then you would say if there's a healthy church, there would be a healthy school system. Or if it's in the decline, perhaps church is in decline. Now, I'm not sure Jesse and Anthony would agree with me on that, but I think that at least that's what the sense I'm getting from this conversation on.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I put pastors and teachers in the same boat, because we're all ministers. We all have the same goal, is to get our constituents to know Jesus and to have a healthier spiritual life. That's really what we all want. Yeah, I think you can take my comments too far and say that's the only thing that we care about are those five distinctives. That's not it. That's why Encounter Bible was designed. We have almost $6 million in the Encounter Bible program.
Hmm.
Because that was the important part, is to get our kids to know Jesus and within the Adventist church, and to take those distinctives and to understand that the state of the dead, if you believe in immortality of the soul, then that really changes everything in the Christian life. The immortality of the soul is one of those big touch points, and that's why the state of the dead is such an important issue.
And that's where that's where I wonder. Sorry.
Our kids are getting bombarded with the immortality of the soul every single day, and every movie and every video they watch and every song that they listen to is at every church. If they go to their friend's church, that's what they hear. And we're saying it differently. And that's, some kids just don't understand that.
That's where I agree about that belief, and I think it's beautiful, but it's also got to be put in its rightful context. It sounds like you guys have tried to do that with this new curriculum, but I guess it puts me at a space of slight, I wonder how this is actually being implemented in the local school level, because at least for me, it seems like we have a lot of our more progressive spaces have totally given up on much of the distinctiveness of Adventism. But it seems like a lot of our conservative spaces put more emphasis on the distinctives than they do on like just Jesus himself and who he is.
Yeah.
And so there's got to be the balance, and we can always argue for balance, but it also seems like one of the things that I've noticed about Adventist education is that it can tend to be so full of stuff. I just remember how much stuff we were invited to do. And that's really cool. Like, you had kids who were in band, who were in sports, who were in pretty much everything that you could imagine. And so your day is full. And then we invite staff members, especially like boarding academy. I was at a mixed boarding / day, all three of us. Auburn Academy is like a day school, but that has dorms on campus for boarding. And it was crazy what we were asking some of the staff members to do. Like, it's not a 9-to-5. And no. I know most teaching isn't, but it's on top of that, you're going to do supervision on the weekend and all this stuff. And it's just crazy. It's crazy how much we're asking people to do. And same thing with students, how much we're like just filling their lives with. And then we're also saying somehow that Jesus is the most important thing. And it feels like those are competing messages at some point. It feels like in those worlds where it's chaos and busyness, what we're trying to say is get prepared for the future. We want to prepare you for your career and all the stuff that you can do in the future. But also there's almost zero space for you to have just time to actually be with Jesus or get to know Jesus at a level that's like meaningful. Because we can educate kids all we want, but there's got to be more than just education, but actual time for experience or people who can mentor and be figures who, what's the right word, have something to give away, have something to for other people to catch. Yeah, infectious. And I know that a lot of that's like up to the individuals. I can name a few people in my life who were like incredibly infectious. Like they had that thing to catch. That's actually a piece of why, actually all three of us, as one of our deans, was just like that. And it was really cool. But it seems like many people's experience in academy is an oversaturation of spiritual events and then also spiritual education. And so you get so oversaturated that by the time you're through it, you haven't really caught, many people haven't caught anything. They've been inundated with information and things to attend.
It's exhausting, yeah.
And so, yeah, it can be spiritually exhausting. And I think it sends mixed messages. And I don't know if that's true of every academy out there. I know that there's like a stat that a lot of our schools are like one room or one teacher, principal deals. But in a lot of the academies, I know that at least are somewhat large, it's chaos. There's so much that their life is filled with. On the one hand, I get the educational aspect of school. But if we're really going to be a place that's about giving people the experience of the encounter of Jesus, it feels like our method of so much stuff gets in the way. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think back at Tacoma Academy. When I went to Tacoma, we had about 250 students. When I went to interview, I couldn't get into the school. There was a 7-Eleven across the street, and there were probably 50 students sitting on the front steps of the school, eating their hot dogs and drinking their Cokes and all that kind of stuff. And trash was all over the place. You can imagine. I sat down with the faculty and said, "What's our goal? What do we want for these students?" And they said, "We want them to be safe. We want them to be safe physically, spiritually, emotionally, et cetera, et cetera." And so we decided to open our gyms up until 8 o'clock at night, every night, in our weight rooms and our wood shop and all of that. It was open, and the faculty, 100% of the faculty, voted and volunteered to do 2 hours every night after school for no extra pay in a day school, in an urban day school, because they wanted the kids in our gymnasium with them rather than on the street with somebody else. And I think that's the point. that we have to find ways keeping kids busy. In many ways, I don't apologize for that, because when they're not busy, they get in trouble. That's, they do things that they, that's where, in my experience, that's where it really gets dicey, is when kids have just nothing to do. And so they're wandering around and they get in trouble. They don't mean to get in trouble. They don't mean to do bad things, but that's what happens.
And well, I get that. But I, for instance, I served as the youth pastor. So I went to Auburn Academy, and then I came back after college and served as the youth pastor across the street. And I remember being told by one of the faculty at the school, we don't really need you there at the church. And it was a bit weird to hear, but I remember understanding it, because there was so much happening constantly at the school. So I get what you mean about keeping kids busy, but there's also a difference between what, between spiritual busyness, so how much you're accomplishing spiritually, or like being educated spiritually, versus having the opportunity to just live it out. As instead of like, because we would have worship in like half of our classes, and then we have Vespers on Friday night, and we had to be at church on Saturday morning, and then you have like band and sports and all these different things happening constantly. So it's like, where do you actually have the space to enjoy or learn or just, you know, catch the experience of Jesus, rather than just constantly running from one thing to the next and being told you need to do certain things and all that. And I don't necessarily have a specific thing that I'm even advocating for, as much as it just seems a little bit counterintuitive, because it feels like we're just inundating kids with so much that at the end of it, they're coming out of it. They have tons of experiences, but Jesus ends up being this thing that's supposed to be important, but never quite feels as important as everything else that's pulling on their attention. And I don't think that's just the fault of those things. I think we're teaching them that to a large degree. And I don't know if you feel that way too, Sean. That's just, there's an outside looking in thought, but.
Yeah, it's, well, and it's a, your mileage may vary experience. You can ask one person from our class, Jesse, and they could speak of a very positive experience with those things. And the other person could speak very negatively. So again, perspective varies so drastically within the experience of education. The same school, the same teachers, the same generation, that a lot of those things I look really fondly back on, like those activities and those things. And I agree with you that the larger issue of what creates the spirituality, the growth, and all three of us had those experiences. Like we wouldn't have, it's this back and forth. It's again, this push and pull, because we had mentors at our academy that guided us in ways that we may not be here today. We're all employed by this church. We got married through the Adventist school system. So there's pieces here.
We're like shining beacons of the Adventist success.
This is the challenges. It's the challenges. Like we can look and put down a list of pros and cons and say there's a lot of good that came out of our experiences. And I look back on some of those things like band and sports and other things and look back and really appreciate those things and appreciate the friends that I made through those activities, the busyness, the ups and the downs. I'm split on that experience, because there's a lot of it I appreciate, but I also agree with you, Jesse, that it can just be busyness. It can just, I agree with you, Larry, that you do, especially as a teacher, you don't want your kids to be given just full autonomy. And I teach junior high. I've had another teacher, a mentor teacher in junior high, say it very aptly, saying that junior high is a daily catastrophe. And that's literally what it is. But it's said with love, because that's probably true. No, but really after 10 years, I can say I love it. I didn't expect to be in this position that long, but it is chaotic. But you have this challenge, like Larry said, to you do want to have structure. You want to have opportunities for them. It is an academic space where we are creating, it sounds cold, but a product. We want to see at the end of 12 years, if they stayed in Adventist education, what is the product we created through this system? And there is that piece of being successful citizens, but also I get where Jesse's coming from, and that if we're talking about spirit-led people, yes, they exist, right? Like we can say that there were people that touched our hearts in the academy system. I think, Jesse, what you might be saying is, was that the exception or the rule, right? Where it might be that happened, but the concern might be, how can we create more of that? Where the system itself, the curriculum, the structure, the organization itself breeds that type of space for that to happen even more than it already does.
That's what I would say is essentially my question listening to you, Larry, and I want to ask a question to you here. I just listening so far, I think I'm struggling. I'm a bit of a cynic. The other guys know that. So I tend to be a bit of a cynic. And I think that where my feeling is trying to understand and quantify how those two things that you described can come together. You were describing how a re-emphasis on the distinctives, which I believe in, I love. Adventist Church has a beautiful truth to share with the world. But then there's also, we want to introduce people to Jesus. We want it to be an encounter, as the curriculum is so named. So how did those two things actually come together? And I think that what I'm wrestling with is something Jesse said a minute ago was, when you go to schools that tend to be a little more, the administrators or teachers, they lean towards the conservative side, it tends to be all mostly intellectual, focus, hyper-focus on the distinctives, and Jesus seems to get lost. But then when you go to the other side of the spectrum, it's either Jesus or maybe not even Jesus at all, and it's just a walking away from the distinctives, and they're focusing on high education, getting into Ivy League, stuff like that. And even my own personal experience from being a youth pastor on the West Coast at La Sierra, I remember the academy across the street, and this is not shots fired at anyone there, but I remember having conversations interpersonally with a lot of the seniors when I was there. And time again, majority of the seniors, a large portion population of the seniors would say to me, I have no intention of being an Adventist after graduation. I'm done as soon as school's over.
And so that's the less quote unquote oppressive space of Adventism, right? Which is pretty wild.
Which is interesting. You would assume that maybe would be in maybe some of the more traditional spaces, but here I was at one of the most progressive academies in the country, and a lot of the seniors were like, this isn't for me. So what happened along the way, and I know there's stats on how like conservative spaces create more long-lasting people of faith in general, but I guess I'm curious for you, what does it look like practically? Are you saying that the solution to marry the two is on an individual level for the teachers, administrators, for their own spiritual lives to be infectious, to be caught, to be rich? Is that what you're arguing, or is it a more, what does it look like?
Yeah. So I think it's the whole gestalt of that, the whole ball of wax. I'm a gestaltist by philosophy. I think that we have to have a curriculum that help students to know Jesus on a personal level and not be that dogmatic, memorize these 12 pages. And then we need to have teachers that can share that and teach that in a way that's compelling. And for instance, if every teacher at Auburn Academy would have had the same relationship to Jesus as your boy's dean, would there be a difference on that campus?
100%.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That would have been
wild. So that's the point. The point is that you have to, and there are kids on Auburn Academy campus that would say that the Bible teacher was the most important person in their life, and that Bible teacher really changed their life, and that the cafeteria director or the maintenance man or whatever. You have to have a variety of people because nobody, not everybody, and there are people that probably hated the dean and couldn't stand the dean. I think it's that gestalt, having the structure to be able to teach it in a way that's not dogmatic and heavy and hard, and then finding a way in every single classroom, from every single pulpit, to humanize, and I don't mean that in a bad way, Jesus, so that he means something and they can have a relationship with a real person and not somebody that's all bloody hanging on a cross and that they have to hold up. Does that make sense? It has to be both.
I think what you just said is a piece of what I felt was somewhat missing from a lot of areas of, because it feels like such a delicate balance between education, which has metric goals, here's the structure of what we're teaching and here's what we want the outcome to be,
and
versus the weird thing that being a disciple is, which is ups and downs, long periods of really no movement in your relationship with Jesus, and all of a sudden some massive mountaintop experience. Like, it's just such a unique thing to each person. So I understand that we can't just take away structure, but what you just described about humanizing Jesus, and I guess the way that I read that is that feels like a lot of the current gen, or like the millennials, Gen Z and Gen Alpha coming up, that the real question is less about what are the Adventist distinctives, and more is just, is Jesus in general applicable to my life? Is there any real reason that matters outside of everything else that's pulling on my attention? And so what you just said, I feel like, answers that question a bit more.
I think that the goal of the Adventist system and the goal of the Adventist church ought to be intrinsic faith versus extrinsic faith. And
say more about that.
Too many times we have extrinsic faith in which teachers and parents tell us that we have to do this or do that, and we have to have faith, we have to have grace, we have to have forgiveness because they say so. What we need to build is an intrinsic faith in which inside of the student, that they feel, that they understand, that they live that intrinsic faith that comes out of them and motivates them. I think that we have built on that extrinsic faith for too long, and yeah, we have to build an intrinsic faith, and that ought to be our goal, is to move them. Every student in the sixth grade has extrinsic faith. In the fifth grade, in the fourth grade, it's extrinsic faith. They believe in Jesus because their parents believe in Jesus. We have to move that extrinsic faith from their parents to themselves. And if we dwell too much on the legalistic part of it, we're just intensifying the extrinsic side of, we do it because that's what the Bible says, but we don't really believe.
I feel like that's, yeah.
In Value Genesis, I had 30 years of Value Genesis in which I led part of that process. And so that intrinsic and extrinsic faith is part of that.
For those of us who aren't familiar with Value Genesis, would you be able to describe that?
Yeah. So every 10 years, the Adventist Church through the North American Division in my office would do a, through La Sierra and the center down there, I forget the name of it right now, Gillespie, would do a survey of 1,500 Academy students. And they would do longitudinal studies as much as possible to see as they move from the sixth grade all the way through the 12th grade, how their faith journey, how their spiritual journey, how their emotional journey, how their religious journey was changing over time. And we did it every 10 years. So I did it over a 30-year period. And I encourage you, if you have not looked at Value Genesis, it is rich in material. For instance, we would ask the question, is there anything you can do to lose the love of Christ? In other words, can you be so bad that Christ doesn't love you? Can you do something so bad? And everybody would say, the majority would say, no, there's nothing you can do to lose that. And then we'd ask the question, what do you have to do to be saved? And we'd have this list of things, what you had to do to be saved. And then we'd ask the question, do you think that you are saved? And they all would give all the right answers about righteousness by faith and a faith journey and all of that, but then they didn't feel like they were saved. That's what we have to get to, is we have to get to the point, and that's really where Encounter Bible came from, is from some of those kinds of statistics, in looking at how kids could not personalize a relationship with Christ. They knew what the answers were. They could quote all of the proof texts, not specifically, but in general. They knew what the right answers were, but they couldn't internalize that to themselves.
Wow, that's really interesting. So that, if I'm hearing you correctly, these long-term studies are recognizing, or they were recognizing, that was the issue. And so it sounds like that's what Encounters came out of.
That's where Encounter came out of, is the new, trying to help them to have that personal relationship, to personalize that spiritual walk, so that they could grow and develop from an intrinsic faith rather than an extrinsic faith.
Yeah. For just a second, moving away from maybe the more spiritual aspects of Adventist education, I am curious about the place of Adventist education when it comes to the overtly non-religious aspects of it, though the goal would be that it's tied in across the board. But what is it about Adventist education, or the ability of a smaller private school system to educate students, that is, from what I'm hearing about from you, creating better outcomes for students? Because there's the anecdotal evidence of, we'll have friends who laugh and they'll be like, yeah, I didn't learn some really basic things I should have, or things like that. And that's people's experience. They don't have a different experience outside of Christian schools, so then they only have the Adventist education to critique. So it's maybe if you went somewhere else, you'd be really grateful for Adventist education or something like that, or maybe vice versa. I don't know exactly, but I guess I'm curious about why not just stick with churches primarily as like your area of, here's where your spiritual space is. Why also do we have an academic space for as a major focus of our church?
I think the genesis of that is counsels that Mrs. White got when she was back in Battle Creek. And I think we've built that system. So for instance, where is spirituality taught? Where are things, our values taught at an Adventist school? In what class?
Oh, I would hope that it was across the board.
That's
would that
the
be
point.
The idea?
The history teacher is going to teach history from an Adventist perspective, from a Christian perspective. And the values they teach in that history class are going to be spiritual values. I work with the Jewish system, Hebrew day schools. In Hebrew day schools, the rabbi has to teach the religion class, but they don't care who teaches math and science and PE. They don't care. You could be an atheist. You could be a satanic warlock. They don't really care who teaches math. From our perspective, that math teacher is just as important, and their spiritual development is just as important as the Bible teacher.
Yeah.
Because if you go to Bible class, you go to math class, and they're cussing and swearing and telling you that this is okay and that's okay, and yeah, if you feel like you're a girl today, oh, do it. If that's what they're teaching, that they're actually teaching values when they're up front talking like that. And our students are catching those values.
You have the research, right? You have both value genesis, and I know, Larry, we haven't brought it up, as cognitive genesis. I know there's been multiple studies, just bigger picture evidence that Adventist education is worth the investment. I know that's a concern for people sometimes, like, why are we putting so much money into Adventist education? I know, bigger picture, and we've had discussions here, because Anthony, Jesse, you guys are pastors. You've done that for a decade. I've been a teacher. I've seen that side. And I've heard those discussions, right? I've been in faculty rooms where I know sometimes the beef is with churches. And I know the other side is probably a church board or committee or the pastors that have a beef with Adventist education or teachers or a school. And that's been a long time division. There's been a product of that for a while. And Larry, you've had maybe a bird's eye view to that experience.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What tends to create that divide where we can't seem to see the other side's value or the way we're supposed to work together? Because that's a classic Ellen White principle or Adventist church principle of the home, school, and church working in this triangle of harmony to create the Adventist experience. And so I know you were talking earlier to Jesse's question of why school, if we could just do it at church. And there's this whole identity wrapped in Adventism that we need those three pillars to really work together to create what Adventism is. at all times. So why is it that we can hear that, but then in practice, we have this challenge where we can't always get along, or there's this experience of like, school is just draining the budget of the church. And then the school side is, how come we don't have more involvement? And Jesse, I know you were told in your specific context, hey, we don't need you. But in my experience, it's, and I love the school I'm at, we're not perfect, but we have 45 constituent churches at my school, San Gabriel Academy. Now that's unusual. It's not usually that many, but we're in Southern California. So there's tons of Adventist churches around us. But when it comes to a synergy or a deep relationship with those churches, there are some great pastors, and I've been able to create Bible studies for my kids, and I bring pastors in from the conference to come and do Bible studies with the students and have that atmosphere. I know that in the past, it can feel like, oh, well, pastors will come for a week of prayer or a chapel. But again, there's this kind of feeling like they are two separate camps. There's you go to church and have that experience, and then you go to Adventist school, and that's its own thing. Whereas it's meant to be this blended experience. And that can happen, but a lot of times it doesn't. Why is it that there's that divide in many spaces?
Let's talk about the small church that's easier to quantify than Loma Linda or La Sierra.
Yeah.
Because yeah,
outliers.
Yeah, they're outliers. Let's talk about the local church, the small church. What does the conference president hold the pastor accountable for? What is his metrics for success?
Often like baptism numbers or things like that.
And tithe growth. Tithe and baptisms. That's, if their tithe is up and they're having baptisms, they're great. But yet that pastor is spending 70 or 80% of their combined budget on the local school.
Ain't that the
truth?
And
so they don't have the resources to do evangelism. They don't have the resources to do some of the outreach that they'd like to do. And so the school is the throttle that is holding back the pastor from being successful in the eyes of the conference office and in their own eyes, because they know that's what the criteria they're being held accountable to. And what we've tried to do over the last number of years is get conference presidents to include the school as part of the success ratio, the success metric for that pastor. And if that school is a success metric, then the pastor is going to engage with the school, because the principal is going to have a talk with the conference president and say, how's the pastor supporting you in education? And that goes both ways. We have lots of small schools in which the school teacher never darkens the door of the church on the weekend. They're so burned out from from what they do every day, 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, that they want to stay home and sleep in on Sabbath morning. And when I was a principal or a superintendent, I hated to go to potlucks, because I was the main course after potluck. They'd all corner you and they'd push you in the corner and why this and why that, and who did this, and this teacher said this and that teacher said that. And my whole spiritual experience for that Sabbath died in the corner of the potluck room.
Yeah.
So I think we have to find ways to encourage both sides to support each other. And I think having the local school as part of the metrics of success for a pastor is important. But we also have to make sure that and it doesn't mean that Sean, that you have to go and teach early teen Sabbath school every week, because you've got the same kids all week long. You shouldn't be teaching them on Sabbath morning. They need to hear a different voice and a different perspective and a different person saying the same things you say, but from a different perspective.
Yeah.
So I think, and too many times in small churches, the teacher is expected to do the janitorial work and to do the treasurer work and they have to be a Sabbath school secretary, and they have to be an elder, and they have to do this. And all of a sudden, they're so, Sean, to your point, they got so many activities, they can't really have time to have that personal relationship to Christ as a teacher.
It goes both ways, right? It's not just the students, it's the teachers that get burnt out too. So it's both sides. Yeah, it really does make sense that it's both. And I can resonate with that. It took me a while to jump on board, to be super active. I love the church I'm at. For instance, I do adult Sabbath school once a month. And that's nice because it's a change of pace. I actually get to talk to adults after literally hours every day talking to little kids. And then I've got a 5 and 2 year old at home. So whenever I get to talk to someone over the age of 12, it's thrilling. That is a big issue, is burnout, right? Like I said at the beginning, maybe it was before we started recording or at the very start, that teachers burn out hard, not just in Adventist education. That's just a problem in education. Yep. There's a huge shortage of teachers, and it's hard right now for schools to hire people. I know that enrollment's a concern. So sometimes schools, the challenge is downsizing, right? Where you have to cut staff. A thing I've seen the last few years, especially, is that we're trying to find teachers. We're trying to find subs and find teacher aides, and they're not there. And so there's that problem on both sides of both enrollment, having enough finances, but also having the manpower to run a program.
The thing I wonder about you, Sean, is that you're still there. Here you haven't burnt out. And I wonder if you actually put in the effort that your kids really needed from you, if you wouldn't have burnt out by now. Yeah, you wouldn't be a teacher anymore, but...
No, in all seriousness, I know you're messing with me, Larry. There's the 5 love languages, and our mentor at Wall University always told us there was a 6th love language, which is ridicule. You love your brother if you make fun of each other. No, but actually, Jesse, to what you just said, there is that sense, and I've seen it in, I hate using the word toxic, I think it's overused, but really the education, and I'll say in Adventism too, there's a classic idea that you wear a million hats. You do so many different things, especially you talk about boarding academy ramped up to 11 for what is expected of you. But even though, you know, we're at a day school, I've seen it happen so many times where it's one thing to burn out as a result of quitting, but there's some that, and Larry, you've seen a teacher that's burnt out, but they're still in their job.
Yeah. Right?
They're collecting a paycheck, but they are not there anymore. They are done. And it's not just older teachers that can happen, but it can be young teachers too. And I've definitely gone through those seasons where you can't see straight because of how tired you are. And so I get it, because there is sometimes an expectation with what it takes to be a spiritual beacon of sorts, while also trying to be competent in your education field. And you're trying to check all these boxes for what you're supposed to be as an Adventist educator. And it can be overwhelming to then feel like you're not reaching or attaining that, and coming up short somewhere. And that was especially tough for me my first year. I remember first year was just trial by fire. There's nothing, no amount of education could have prepared me for my first year of teaching. And there's some crazy statistic that at least half of teachers quit by year 3, just across the board. So it's especially rough at the start, because you don't know what it is until you get into it. It's just unbelievably difficult. And so I'm saying all that, Jesse, to your point, that there is a sense of duty and desire to be those things to someone. But then the reality is, the truth you have to face as a teacher is you are going to be short somewhere. You're going to be deficient somewhere, which is what Larry said earlier, is you need a multitude of teachers that have different strengths and weaknesses that allow for, hopefully, a product to come together in one school that creates a more holistic, complete picture, despite those shortcomings. And we have to work together. And there really does need to be, I think, a better relationship with churches. Because I think part of the reason teachers are getting burnt out is because there isn't that synergy all the time to work on what mission is. We shouldn't just be our own isolated system. My school shouldn't just be isolated. It should be part of this bigger movement. And that creates hopefully a better support system for our teachers, but at the same time, pastors. I know pastors get burnt out too when it's a lonely place to be a pastor. I'm a pastor's kid. I know what it looks like to be a pastor's family. It's a lonely place for many people. And so they should be supported too as leaders in the church. So yeah, I don't know why that's been such a struggle to not have those two isolated camps, but I think that's part of why there's burnout, why there's animosity at times between those two groups.
I guess I'm...
Anthony, was that you? That was the timing of that. To go from just a serious moment to just Anthony has all the power to use these sound effects. Oh my word.
Let's talk about this. Larry, I'm curious. So Sean just talked about burnout. You had mentioned finances as some of the if we're just going to talk about the tension between churches and schools. And you had talked about making the metric of how the school is doing attached to pastoral, towards the pastoral metric as well. But when I was pastoring up at I was at a smaller church of, we had probably like 130 in attendance rotating. So we're like 90 to 100 on a Saturday. And we had a budget. One of the things is that conferences have tended to encourage churches to buy property and to build quickly. And so a lot of churches are carrying mortgages. And then you have to do all of the support stuff. So we're not just paying rent. We're also paying insurance, not so much insurance, but we're paying all the utilities, all this stuff that we have to do just to support the running of the church, right? So now we're not even, when we're talking about mortgage and support services, like we're not even talking about ministry yet at all. And at my church, we were running, what is that? 70% of our budget was mortgage and support. So that's not even ministry. None of that is. But then if you were just to take the 30% we had left to dedicate towards outside, or like towards ministry in the church and outside of the church, out of that 62% of it went to subsidizing our local school. So when you took 100% of our budget, all said and done, I had 11% of it at the end of the day to give to ministries, and 11% of, this is an old budget, so I feel comfortable saying the number at this point. I think it was like $8,900 or something like that a month. So whatever 11% of that is, that's what we were left with to put into all of the different ministries that we had.
As $900 pretty much?
Yeah, it was something like that. So it cripples the local church to have all of these financial stuff, all this financial stuff put on them. At the same time, I also believe in Adventist education. But it just feels like our financial circumstances, along with like giving tithe and all that stuff, like the financial reality that a church is faced with is really challenging, especially the small ones. So it becomes this thing where it's like the school succeeds
at the expense.
The school constantly, it can feel like that, even though I know it's not totally true. And so I get what you're saying about adding the metric of how the local school is doing to the past, but there's got to be a way of cooperation between schools and churches that is mutually beneficial to both. And I'm all for, we had a push to get like an inventory of all the school-age students or school-age kids at your church, and then getting as many as you could into Adventist education. And they had like scholarships that they were willing to put out. And it was a layperson-led thing. It was actually really cool. That was a really cool movement that really, I think, helped save a lot of the schools in the Washington Conference around the time I was pastoring there, just pre-COVID. And that was cool. But again, we were still left with, we have so little money to do anything at the local church level. So there was support from our local church, but there was also just like, we can't keep spending this percentage of our budget on this. I don't know. I don't know if you have a solution. As much as just like, how are churches and schools supposed to work together outside of just being present at each other's spaces? Like, how is that actually supposed to function in a way that's mutually beneficial?
I think for the pastor to be seen in the... So if the pastor's only seen by these kids in a day school, Sabbath morning up front, and that's the only relationship they have with the pastor, is that 45 minutes when they're up front speaking.
Yeah.
Then even if the pastor has something, is infectious and has something to share, the students aren't around them enough to catch it. So I think that there's an important part of the church being part of the school program, not just coming and doing a worship and then leaving, but actually standing around in the recess time and bantering back and forth with the kids and playing kick and all of that kind of stuff.
What that starts to feel like, though, to a local pastor at a certain point is I have to write a sermon. So I have 40 hours in a week. A lot of some of that is just Saturday morning. So let's just say I have 32 hours in a week. I got to write a sermon, run meetings, do visitations. If I want to do anything past that, I have 5 to 10 hours a week maybe to do that. And then in addition, I'm being asked to be at the local school to do all these things when there's a decent number of staff there to be able to care for those kids. It's not that I don't want to be. I did when I was near local schools, like I would show up and I had a good relationship with students. I coached soccer and that was a really meaningful experience. I would advocate that people do that, but that's a lot of time that I'm spending at a local school that takes away from what I'm doing in my own duties at the local church. And so to some degree, I understand what you're saying, but it also feels like we're constantly asking for mutual support both directions when both sides are maxed out. So I guess that's what I'm wondering is I'm all about the mutual support, but how it's a lot to ask.
In the Adventist church, and my statistics are old. Mm-hmm. So am I, but that's beside the
We prefer the term wise.
Yeah. two things. 45% of the baptisms in the Adventist church come from schools and summer camps. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't the church be interested in at least half of the baptisms that are available? They ought to be. The other thing is, when I was in Michigan, I did a statistical study, and I took all the churches in the Mission Conference. We had 200. Is that right? Anyhow, we had a lot of churches and a lot of schools. Mm-hmm. We had 55 schools in Michigan when I was there. And I took all of the churches, and I looked at their tithe and membership growth over a 5-year period. And I took and compared those that were constituent to a school and those were not constituent to a school. Those that were not constituent to a school, as a whole, their tithe and their membership went down every year over a 5-year period. And those that were constituent to a school, their membership and tithe went up every year. So there ought to be a financial incentive to be part of a school in the long term for the church to be part of that program, because it's a growth issue.
But churches are often, it can come across as almost a penalty. When your tithe goes up, your percentage of subsidy goes up. Okay, you're getting more tithe, but now a significant number of that. So you don't even get your tithe back outside of a local church, a local pastor's salary. But now, okay, so now we're giving more money away to the conference and we're giving more money away to the school. And it's not about, I don't want lives changed. I don't want kids here going to our local. I totally support that. And most pastors, I think, do. But it's also, this isn't financially viable for many places, especially the smaller locations, because you end up just hemorrhaging all of the money that does come in and then seeing diminishing returns even as you get more students. So that's a pretty challenging space to be in. I don't know if that's been looked at by
from
the GC level down. And
So part of the issue is we're trying to encourage conferences and unions to share back down to the local church as much funding as we can. And we're giving we're giving the conferences and the unions more money, and we're saying, don't keep it, push it back down to the local conference. And those local conferences then ought to be pushing that money to the local church and the local school.
That makes a lot of sense. And if that happened, it would, I think, make the relationship between schools and churches, at least behind the scenes, a little bit better. I don't know, there's pastors out there who they got a big passion for Adventist education. And so they're all for that. But there's other pastors, like, for instance, my thing and I think this is the experience of some other pastors as well, was I'm trying to create a church community where students who graduate will want to even be at after they graduate.
Yeah.
And some of that involves worship style. I need to be able to hire a worship pastor or worship leader in order to be able to do that. And I can only give them $500 a month. Like, it starts to create these issues where it's like, okay, I get that a lot of our resources are going into this, and rightfully, but we're also shooting ourselves in the foot past that when it comes to resources. And so it's just, it feels like a part of the conversation that, yes, if money gets pushed down through in back into local churches, it's like, okay, cool. Like, now we can do something with this. So this is a mutually beneficial thing, but that's a challenge. I don't know how many people of our listeners even know about these challenges that a lot of pastors experience behind the scenes on this, but that feels like a challenge. But all that being said, I guess I'm curious about your hope for Adventist education. And you've said that it's increased over the last few years. What's the hope for trajectory in the future for Adventism, Adventist education?
My biggest hope for Adventist education is not increase in numbers. That'll come. If we focus on, we have to have enough enrollment to exist, but that shouldn't be the issue. I think my hopes and dreams for Adventist education are more spiritually infectious teachers and preachers, so that we can, I think we need to spend more time. We're in a bad spot because we can't, as Sean said, we can't find teachers. We're closing a local school here in Idaho because we can't find a teacher. They've got the money, they've got the students, but we can't find a teacher in Salmon, Idaho, one of the most beautiful places on God's green earth, up in the mountains in Idaho, about an hour from Yellowstone, and we can't find a teacher to go over there, and we're going to have to close that school.
Wow.
It's really difficult because we don't have the bodies to put in, but we do need to make sure that when we put somebody in a school, that they're not just a body, that this isn't the interview process.
You have a heartbeat.
Yeah, you have a heartbeat and you're
not dead.
Yeah, it was interesting. One of my questions I always ask any new employee is, define for me what an Adventist is. And you learn so much from that answer.
Sure.
Are they a cultural Adventist? Are they a liberal Adventist that the values of the church don't matter anymore?
Mm-hmm.
Are they a legalistic Adventist that they're going to beat the kids up?
Yeah.
So I think that's an important thing, and we need to do a better job of helping our teachers to have the time, Jesse, to have the space to grow and develop, and then support them to the best of our ability so that they can be infectious in the classroom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Larry, I appreciate you coming on. There's obviously any direction, we probably opened five different cans of worms that could easily be expounded upon in many more hours of discussion. I think our hope is to do this series in a way that, again, creates, like everything else we do, create conversations, get people thinking, because a lot of times there's a sense of apathy or indifference. And that's not just an Adventist education. That can be anything mission-minded within the church. Right. And I think that's where it goes back to the point that any deficiencies we find or concerns in the church is a product of our people, our members. So whatever's happening in our larger church body is going to be a product of whether it's healthcare, Adventist education, mission work in the local church. Wherever it's at, it's a product of what we're going through. And so I think we're just trying to take a step back and look at what is the value of Adventist education? What's the mission supposed to be? And I appreciate your view because you've been at the highest office of the NAD for that experience. And you see some things that others haven't. And so I appreciate you sharing those things and just giving us that ability to ask questions. Yeah, it's appreciated. So thank you for taking the time.
All right. God bless.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Larry.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Anthony here. So great to be with you once again. It's been a little while since we had a new outro, but wanted to hop on just to give you some updates. So first and foremost is we're just so grateful for all of you who journeyed along with us through the Polarize series. It was a bit of a long journey, but we're so grateful for those of you who followed along, who engaged, sent us emails, DMs, text messages. We really appreciated the conversations. Speaking of conversations, we have embarked on a brand new journey, as you may have noticed. We are having conversations all about Adventist education. So if you listen to this episode, there is more to come. You can look forward to that. And it's a series of conversations we've been excited about for a while. We've been sitting on in the vault. So we're excited to finally get those to you. So we hope that you enjoy. As always, our mission at Seeking What They Sought is to have honest conversations about Seventh-day Adventism. To that end, please feel free to reach out. We love having conversations with you guys, whether it's through email, sending us a DM on social media, or if you have our contact info, just reach out to us directly, send us a text. There's a few of you who you always text me or you may call after episodes. I really appreciate that about you guys, and we really love having conversations. Don't forget to reach out. We love chatting. It may take us a little bit because we all have full-time jobs and families, but we love responding. Thank you so much for those of you who do reach out. I also want to not let this time go by without thanking each one of our patrons who support us financially on Patreon. We are really grateful. I want to just pause here and acknowledge, this is for Sean, that I pronounce patron and Patreon differently. Sean always makes fun of me because I mess up how to say Patreon. I'm worried now that I've said that, I'm going to mess it up. Here we go. We're going to power through. But thank you to each one of our 46 patrons. We're really grateful for each one of you. If you hadn't noticed recently, maybe you didn't, we recently in the last year had a bit of a facelift in our camera quality, and the reason is because of our patrons. It's because of your financial support we were able to purchase new video equipment just to elevate the level of quality that we could bring to you guys and content we could make. So we're really grateful for your support, those of you who do. If you'd like to support us, it's not a pressure thing. We're not looking to become rich off of this, but if you'd like to support us financially, you can give just a single dollar a month, and it goes a long way to help us continue to make great content for you guys. Grateful, thank you so much. If you're trying to stay up to date with us, just on what we're doing, on different episodes that are coming out, on the next series that's coming out, a great way to do that is to follow us on Instagram. It's our home base, just staying up to date on what's going on. If you didn't know, we're on all the social medias pretty much. We're on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok. I think we're even on Threads, although I don't know that we use that very much. But side note, I really love Threads, by the way. I feel like it's like a more, it's like a less insane version of Twitter. It's like a little more personable. I don't know. I get that vibe. What do you guys think? Maybe drop a little comment. But we're on all on all of the different social medias, but Instagram is our home base. So if you'd like to stay up to date in what's going on with Seeking What They Sought, give us a follow on Instagram. And we also do different things on Instagram. Like sometimes we do Instagram lives where Sean and I make a fool out of ourselves, or we take different polls and things like that. We post memes. We just have a fun time. So follow us on Instagram. Last but not least, could you leave us a review on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you listen, because it really helps us actually in the algorithm to help new people get their eyes on the podcast. So if you could just go in, give us a little, hopefully a 5-star review, but be honest. But yeah, hopefully a 5-star review, that really helps us just in the algorithm, the way that these things work these days. So we really appreciate it. Okay, I think that's everything for now. We will see you next time on Seeking What They Sought.